You are listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by Sports Tours International. Whether you want to ride the biggest sportive events in the world or watch some of the best riders in the world's biggest races, Sports Tours International can take you right to the heart of the action. Maybe you've always wanted to tackle the Étape du Tour, or perhaps the new Étape du Tour de France Femme, which is launching this year, has caught your eye. Or perhaps the Marmot in France or the Challenge 312 in Mallorca are more your thing. Either way, Sports Tours International will get you to the start line in style, giving you the chance to feel what it's like to ride like a pro. You'll stay in great accommodation close to the events, and Sports Tours International will look after you and your bike throughout. There'll be backup, mechanical support and additional feed stops, so all you have to do is pedal and enjoy the ride. Perhaps you haven't got a big sportive on your agenda this year, but you would like to go and watch one of the big races. Maybe you've always dreamed of seeing the Tour de France or one of the major classics such as the Tour of Flanders or Paris-Roubaix, but you don't really know how to go about organising all of the logistics. Well, let Sports Tours International take you to the roadside and give you a front row view. There's a range of packages for the major races. You could watch the Tour of Flanders from the Alpe de Quaremont, Paris-Roubaix from the Velodrome, or enjoy the Grand Départ of the Tour de France. Perhaps you want to combine the two. You could ride in the Pyrenees and Alps and then watch the Tour come past. Or splash out and enjoy the luxury of a full VIP experience in Paris. Or even spend the day in an official Tour de France car, getting as close to the action as you possibly can. Go to sportstoursinternational.co.uk to check out the full range of cycling tours available. A big thank you to Sports Tours International for sponsoring our coverage of the early season races. Now it's on with the show.
Hello, and joining you on February the 5th, 2025, in a week when Slovenia's most popular sportsman made the most shocking exit from Dallas since Bobby Ewing. Yes, I am talking about Luka Doncic moving from the Dallas Mavericks to the LA Lakers and not Tadej Pogacar. My name is Daniel Freiber. I am the host of this episode of the Cycling Podcast, in which we may have to rush to the defense of our own American Maverick, Mr. Larry Warbass. More about that in a second. And we'll also bring you up to speed with a frantic first week of racing on our home continent, that is Europe. Joining me to do all of that is a man who a few weeks ago made the most shocking reappearance since Bobby Ewing. It is Lionel Burney.
Hello, Daniel.
And a man who remains as dreamy as those 31 episodes in which Bobby was well thought to have headed to the oil ranch in the sky. It is Rob Hatch.
Hello. I'm not sure to think about that intro.
Do you know what I'm talking about, Rob?
I think it was parodied in a wonderful BBC introduction to a brilliant semi-final of the USA 94 World Cup. That's what I know it better for.
We are, of course, talking about Dallas. The hit 70s. This shows how old we are. To be honest,
and
it's
80s.
Probably a bit...
And 80s, to be fair.
And 80s. I'm just about long enough in the tooth to remember Dallas.
Basically,
do you know what?
Bobby Ewing was the most popular character, and they killed him off, and the ratings for the next season went down, and so they decided to bring him back. But of course, they killed the character, so what were they going to do? So they decided that he would come out of the shower, and the whole of the previous season had just been a dream. Like, it just
everything
been a dream.
That happened,
amazing. Everything that happened was just a dream.
It got me thinking, chaps. If you could apply the same, or sort of sprinkle the same sort of Dallas dust over a season in the history of professional cycling, pretend that nothing in the previous 12 months had actually happened and had all been a dream. When would be a good year to just erase?
Wow. I tell you what, Daniel, that is a great talking point for the Cannibal and Badger. We should get friends of the podcast to contribute. Oh, start a thread. The Dallas season. Which one would we erase? I suppose I erased last season. I when you say, oh, so-and-so won something last season, it's just not there in my kind of pull-down menu of experiences. So I'm kind of scrambling to catch up. I sort of metaphorically spent the whole year in the shower, didn't I? Came out very wrinkly and crinkly.
Here's me thinking the whole Dallas thing was all about JR. I mean, that shows how much I've seen of it, or little I've seen of it.
Let's move on. Can I make another reference to your intro there, Daniel? The Houston Rockets basketball team. I wondered whether they might have a copyright claim on the Unibet Tietema Rockets, because the logo on the tracksuit tops is very similar to the old Houston Rockets logo, the NBA basketball team. So maybe it's inspired by rather than a copied off the internet by version. I don't know, but I like this idea of cycling teams with, you know, names like American sports teams. Maybe listeners could suggest some. We've got the Ineos Grenadiers, haven't we? The Unibet Tietema Rockets. Any others? The UAE Emirates.
I'm sure we can come up with some facetious and probably scandalous and maybe libelous ones if you give us a few minutes. Chaps, how are we otherwise?
All right. Not too bad.
All right, Rob, you've had a rough week.
Yeah, it's not been the greatest week, but here we are.
You got through it. I resisted the temptation. There were a few sort of Bobby Ewing references that pertained related to how you've been feeling over the last week or so that I could have used, but I resisted the temptation. Lionel, of course, you were with Rob last week at the home cycling in Mallorca.
That's why it could have been a better week.
Chaps. No, I wasn't referring to that. Oh, you chaps chronicled.
Wonderful.
Your week. Super.
We did. I hope you were referring to the fallout and the flack that went in Rob's direction as a result of the British cycling broadcast rights decision by TNT, Warner Brothers Discovery. There's been a lot of discussion about that, also on the Cannibal and Badger. It's a subject we'll probably return to at some point, but maybe not right now. But maybe you were referring to my presence in Mallorca, just a kind of rain cloud from the UK headed over there to Soyer, just to sort of drizzle on Rob for the week. And the grey clouds closed in. No, I had a wonderful time over there in Mallorca. The series seemed to go pretty well. One little corrections corner, though, which a couple of people pointed out. I said on Saturday's episode, I did say that the last time the Vuelta went to Mallorca was in 1991. And I'd completely forgotten that it actually returned in 1998. They had a couple of stages of the Vuelta in Mallorca in 1998. One was won by Fabrizio Guidi, and the time trial up in Alcudia was won by Abraham Alano. And I don't know how that slipped my mind, but a couple of people pointed that out. Nevertheless, still 27 years since the Vuelta went to Mallorca, and it didn't really, that fact that I omitted didn't really change the sort of substance of the discussion we were having about whether the Vuelta might one day go back to Mallorca. But I think over the course of the week hit the 70% accuracy threshold, so a fairly good week's work for early in the season, something to build on anyway.
Starting the Vuelta a España may well start in Mallorca next year. May it not?
They've been listening to Lionel. There you go, they've been listening to you.
Yes. Yes, I believe so. I think the rumour's been gathering steam. In fact, over the last week, I saw some reports about that. Nothing confirmed yet, but it wouldn't surprise me. I think, Rob, you and I speculated last year about whether a Sakalobra time trial might be possible. Probably not, unless one involved.
Well, I came up with a wacky races format for the Sakalobra time trial, but that would be fantastic, wouldn't it? I mean, we're ahead of the curve here, aren't we? Or maybe close enough behind the curve to appear ahead of the curve, perhaps, Rob. I don't know.
Well, race presentation right down in Sawyer Square around the corner here. A little ride down to the start, then get on the boat to Sakalobra, as Daniel suggested last year, and then some sort of time trial, maybe a traditional mountain time trial, maybe Lionel's wacky races idea, and there you go. How about that? I still, in all serious terms, believe that they should be going back to the Canary Islands first, but anyway, progress is progress if we do get off the mainland.
Well, chaps, as much as we like to gaze into our crystal balls, it also befalls to us to recap a little bit, fill you in on what's been going on in the world of professional cycling, the traditional, now traditional, weekly sort of news bring and buy. Everyone brings a talking point, news story that's caught their eye over the previous 7 days. Who would like to go first this week?
Sounds like a quiz question. Rob. I'm going to go first then. I'll tell you what, I'm going to open the boot, set up my stall, and I guess it's sort of, I'm using that little analogy because that's what it looked like in the incident I'm referring to. It was like a bit of a car boot sale, wasn't it, at the end, when riders were having to get jerseys back on, get warm again, back on the buses. I'm talking about day four of Challenge Ciclista Mallorca, what should have been day four, if the organisers' strong words are to be believed. Safety. It's early in the season, but again, we're talking about it. I said both positive and negatively, thankfully, and unfortunately we're talking about it. Unfortunately, because this is something that has been happening with increased regularity in the last few years, isn't it? Organisers and riders at loggerheads having a go at each other. And it played out very publicly into the weekend, even after Lionel and I have been talking about it on the Mallorca podcast last week. And it was really driven by the organiser of the Challenge Ciclista Mallorca, Manuel Hernandez. And he was out here in the local press having a go at the riders, talking about them not behaving correctly. And Adam Hansen, who I think he's doing a great job defending his riders' interest. I don't always agree with his style, but he's doing a fantastic job defending his riders' interest and getting the message out to the public about what he thinks should be happening. And he was very, very quick to put the organiser of the race in his place, saying, well, you obviously didn't know it, mate, but the rules have changed. There are new protocols in place this year. Three riders per race being appointed to speak to people. And if the organisers weren't doing their job, then they weren't doing their job. And I think I said as well to Lionel that I had empathy and sympathy for the organisers because it is a small event. They rely on racing to happen. And if the conditions aren't great, that's just unfortunate for them. What they can do, however, is increase the safety. And after we talked about it, Lionel, there was one incident that I saw on the fifth race where riders were riding into Palma. It was a very quick peloton of riders coming in towards the finishing circuits, and they went down a slip road to a motorway. They didn't go on the motorway, but they went parallel, and there was just a little fleet of cones separating a moving motorway where the speed limit is at 120 kilometres per hour and a peloton of bike riders. All it would have taken was for somebody to clip a cone while they're fighting for position, they're going into the final circuits, for a car accident to happen, for something to happen there, and you would have had a shocking, shocking incident on your hands. So for that to happen a day after the cancellation of a race because of a meeting between the organisers and the riders as a result of what happened on the road with wet roads that can be treacherous in Mallorca, I thought that was a sort of a real eye-opener as well. So just to touch on the safety and the fact that, yes, we might not all like it. I, as a broadcaster, want to broadcast racing. You, as fans at home, want to watch. Riders want to ride. And that point was reiterated by Adam Hansen. But we find ourselves here again. I think the only positive thing to add to this is that the riders now have a strong voice.
Rob, I hope you're not going to leave out the most succulent part of this story, which was what the organiser of the Challenge Mallorca called Joaquín Rojas.
No, I think I sent you this. I'll give you the honour of putting this in.
No, go on. I haven't got it in front of me.
If you just bear with me, I will get it up in front of me. But
a shameless liar.
There you go.
Less,
yeah.
Wasn't it?
Well, it was basically
shameless, shameful liar.
It was like playground stuff, wasn't it? From Manuel Hernandez calling Jose Joaquin Rojas a shameless liar, saying that he made things up when they were talking about the incidents that had happened on the road. That's how it sort of really started to snowball into the press into the weekend. It was a bizarre sort of snowballing of the story into the weekend.
Lionel, your news item this week.
Well, yeah, we will talk about cycling in this episode a bit later on, but mine is a geopolitical story that caught my eye. The Guardian reported that the campaign group Human Rights Watch last week called on three football clubs, this is about cycling, but three football clubs, Arsenal, Bayern Munich and Paris Saint-Germain, to cut their sponsorship deals with Visit Rwanda because of the worsening humanitarian crisis in the country. Now, everyone will know that the UCI World Road Race Championships are due to be held in Kigali, Rwanda in September, the first edition to be held on the continent of Africa. Now, the worsening humanitarian crisis referred to there is that the M23 rebels have captured Goma, which is a city very close to the border in neighbouring Democratic Republic of Congo. The UN maintains that it's actually the Rwandan army that's in control of the M23 group. And there have been more than 700 casualties in the conflict in the past week. More than 400,000 people have been forced to leave their homes so far this year. The Rwandan government has denied direct military involvement in the conflict and said its troops are at the border to protect their territory. But Human Rights Watch has listed a number of concerns about Rwanda, and this is obviously on the radar of the UCI, but they said there are no plans to move the Road Race World Championships from Rwanda this year, and has also emphasised its wish for cycling to be a powerful ambassador for peace, friendship and solidarity. Now, I should just say, Kigali is about 160 kilometres away from the border, and both the Rwandan government and UCI say that the country is entirely safe for tourism and business. I'm going to speak a bit later on this afternoon to somebody from Amnesty International, just because I don't really know the situation in Rwanda. I want to get a bit more information and also work out what the implications are for international sporting events taking place in the country and why there is always this call for events perhaps not to be taking place in a country when, well, there seems to be a sort of a two-tier application of sort of the moral values, really. I just feel like elite sport generally, it's a bit like that old joke about the Queen and her public engagement. Wherever she goes, smells of fresh paint. Global sporting bodies, you know, and the events, they're using the events to show the best side of countries and hide away the worst side of things. You know, the term that we've come to use is sports washing. And it's sort of everywhere in sport. And I just want to get a bit more of an idea of what is actually going on and what the implications for an event like the UCI Road World Championships might be. So we will maybe play a little bit of that at the end of this episode, or if not, I'll find a way to get it onto the 1101 Cappuccino this week.
Did I see as well that the tour of Rwanda, which is due to take place in the next couple of weeks, was apparently due to take place around 15 kilometres away from the border, actually. One of the stages was due to go very, very close to the border. So there had been talk of a more immediate concern from some teams on that front as well.
Would we like to wager where the World Championships will take place if the Rwanda Worlds does fall through?
Martigny.
I think a few quid on Saudi Arabia might be a shrewd bet. Anyway.
Shall I ask Amnesty International about Saudi Arabia as well in the same call, perhaps?
More about Saudi Arabia later in brighter news. Chaps, my item of interest this week is something we touched on last week. We alluded to last week, we anticipated that a ban on the repeated inhalation of carbon monoxide was imminent. We didn't know whether it was just the UCI or whether it was WADA who was going to extend a ban to all sports. Well, the UCI, sure enough, the UCI Management Committee did announce last week that they are banning the repeated inhalation of carbon monoxide. I'm just going to read a bit of the UCI statement on this matter. As a reminder, carbon monoxide is commonly used in sports medicine to measure total hemoglobin mass and blood volume, especially to examine the effects of endurance training and altitude exposure on oxygen carrying capacity. However, its repeated inhalation can result in acute and chronic health problems. Such symptoms can, well, it lists symptoms and then says such symptoms can worsen at any time and develop into problems with heart rhythm, seizures, paralysis and loss of consciousness. The more pertinent point, however, is that it has been alleged that repeated use of carbon monoxide inhalation can have a similar effect to EPO, for example, increase hemoglobin, increase the body's capacity to use oxygen. And this is where it becomes problematic. The statement goes on, the inhalation of carbon monoxide will remain authorised within a medical facility and under the responsibility of a medical professional experienced in the manipulation of this gas for medical reasons and in line with the following restrictions. Only one CO inhalation to measure total haemoglobin mass will be permitted. A second CO inhalation will be authorised 2 weeks after the haemoglobin measurement. Now, why is this subject of any interest to us whatsoever? Well, we've covered it on several occasions. On the eve of last year's Tour de France, Escape Collective, our friends, remain our friends at Escape Collective, they published an article which highlighted the fact that three World Tour teams, they reported that three World Tour teams, that was Visma Lisa Bike, UAE Team Emirates and Israel Premier Tech, were using carbon monoxide inhalation as a diagnostic or as a sort of measuring tool to measure their riders' total haemoglobin, we presume before and after altitude camps, to find out whether the altitude camps were working. That article did not suggest that they were using it for nefarious reasons, in a nefarious way. However, in the sort of hype that was generated around that story and in subsequent months, there has been maybe a little bit of confusion about whether this practice is rife in professional cycling, whether it's rife in other sports, whether it's something the UCI needed to look at and take action against. They have taken action now. However, as we explained last week, what makes this doubly, triply problematic is that repeated inhalation of carbon monoxide for performance enhancement was and will remain undetectable by common consensus. Also remains to be seen, the UCI haven't actually published their rule, their specific new rule on this matter. They've just released a statement. What the protocol, what the allowed protocol, they talk about it being allowed in medical facility, what exactly that is. What the teams will not be able to do is own the machines. There's a company called Detalo that makes the most sort of popular, the most widely used carbon monoxide rebreather. They will not be able to possess, is the word used in the statement, these machines. Israel and Visma certainly used a Detalo machine. We think UAE used a different kind of machine. So what should we make of this all? Well, a good thing in the sense that we don't want this to become common practice in professional cycling. We don't want teams, riders using carbon monoxide rebreathing to increase their haemoglobin artificially. Unfortunately, as I said, it can't be detected. I remain pretty skeptical that it has been used based on lots of conversations with people in teams and in endurance sport over the last few months. I think there was also some confusion about Jonas Vingegaard's quotes at the Visma Lisa Bike Media Day recently. That was just a couple of weeks ago. He gave an interview to Le Monde in which he was initially quoted as saying that he thought other teams' riders had maybe been misusing it. Visma Lisa Bike and their press spokesperson corrected that or subsequently issued a clarification. They thought that Vingegaard's statements had been mistranslated or misrepresented in Le Monde, and they said of course he would not accuse other riders of malpractice and that had not been his intention. And poor old Larry has been copping it still, because Larry took umbrage on our podcast, on our airwaves, at the original story in Escape Collective and the way that it was sort of spun and presented. And poor old Larry. Maybe we'll have him back next week or in a couple of weeks, certainly. We're due to check in with the Motown Maestro and he can defend himself. And that's all, unless you chaps have anything to add.
Chute, chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind me to tell you that this episode is also sponsored by Indeed. Now, if your company is looking to hire somebody, you want to attract the best possible candidates, but you also want to fill the vacancy quickly, because for as long as the job is left unfilled, it's costing the company time and money and putting strain on your other team members who are scrambling to cover the gaps. When it comes to hiring, Indeed really is all you need. You won't struggle to get your jobs seen because Indeed sponsored jobs will help you stand out and hire somebody quickly. It means that your job post jumps to the top of the page for the relevant candidates. It's really matching the job to the people. And that means that you can hire somebody quickly. In fact, in the time I've been talking to you, 23 hires have been made on Indeed according to their data. There are no monthly subscriptions, no long-term contracts. You only pay for the results you get. There's no need to wait any longer. Speed up your hiring process right now with Indeed. Cycling Podcast listeners can get a £100 sponsored job credit to get your job more visibility at indeed.com/cycle. Just go to indeed.com/cycle right now and you'll be helping to support the show by saying you heard about Indeed on the Cycling Podcast. Indeed.com/cycle. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Well, chaps, that's all the off-the-bike nonsense dealt with.
Now, yes, come on. Talk about cycling, Daniel. Come on.
Now for some cyclocross and six-day racing. No, actually, in all honesty, I did want to talk about cyclocross and six-day racing, right? Albeit briefly.
Have you got a temperature?
For two reasons. I want an excuse to quote or to reuse a moniker, a sobriquet that our good friend Alexandre Rousse came up with for Mathieu van der Poel in L'Équipe at the weekend. He called him the sheriff of the undergrowth, which I thought was rather nice.
I like that, yeah.
And as for six-day racing, chaps, well, I'm back in Berlin, and it was six-day weekend last weekend. That's not why I'm back in Berlin. However, that was just a happy coincidence. I was not in attendance at the 6 day. But Rob, you know, you followed the 6 day, you've worked on the 6 day scene over the last few years, and you know that it's had experience, I don't know, with the growing pains or certain development pains over the last few years. Various attempts to revive the 6 day scene. The Berlin event, Berlin 6 day, is one of the sort of grand dams, I suppose, of 6 day racing. It has a very long and glorious tradition, and been reduced to 2 days in recent years, but by all accounts it was pretty successful this year. 6,500 people there on day one, 8,000 on day two, and reports of a much younger audience that's emerging and starting to attend the Berlin 6 day. It was also Till Reinhardt's last 6 day. He is one of the hitters, isn't he, Rob, in 6 day racing, and that was thought to be one of the reasons why the attendance was so healthy. That event, the Berlin 6 day, has been overseen, masterminded for a few years by a gentleman called Valt Miltovits. And he is, Robert, is he Latvian or Lithuanian? And he used to be involved in basketball at a high level. Anyway, he's taken this on and he's tried to be very innovative over the last few years, again, to try to revive the Berlin 6 day, and seems to be doing a pretty good job. Although I think its future and the future of 6 day racing is, I wouldn't say it's moot, but it's certainly still a struggle for everyone involved.
I think as well, you could start with this debate and go about how popular track racing is. You said getting a different audience in, a younger audience. You've got the places where they tried to expand in the English-speaking world a few years ago, around 10 years ago now, when the London 6-day came back and you had those full evenings. I mean, pretty much full, almost full six, for a full six nights in London. It was an exceptional atmosphere, certainly for two or three years. And then we've seen it sort of shrink again into its more traditional heartlands. You know, you talk about Berlin, Bremen is a big one in Germany as well. There's Rotterdam in the Netherlands. Years ago, you had Zurich as well. But I mean, the problem that you could get to if you really dig a little deeper is the root of it all. The track cycling calendar, it's still lacking, I think, a real form. Is it the right time of year for a lot of the events still now, you know, the sort of medal events, the points gaining events? A lot of those are in the summer. Is it a summer sport? No, I think it's a winter sport, and certainly it should be a winter sport if you want to attract those crossover riders you need from the road to get the crowds in and things like that. And I think it's sort of lost its way there. Usually our Track Champions League's been a really interesting product in itself. We've had good crowds in a lot of the venues, you know, an opportunity for racers to race week after week after week in a more sort of serious thing. But it's not the same as the 6-day. This is sort of competition. The 6-day is a bit of a show that's put on, isn't it? So I want that to continue because it is a great way of getting, as you say, young people into it. But where does it fit in with the rest, I think, is the eternal problem. And until you have some sort of stability, organisers are going to maybe struggle financially. But I'm delighted to hear that the Berlin Velodrome was full, because it's a wonderful track, that. The architecture right in the middle of the park almost looks like a spaceship's landed in the middle of the park there. And you go down, it's a wonderful arena inside. And yeah, when it's full, some great noise in there.
I remember going to the Berlin World Championships, I think, was it 1999? And there was hardly anybody there at that velodrome you're talking about there, Rob. And I do think that the evolution of track racing over the years, and the reason that the Ghent 6 has survived and thrived, is because the emphasis is on the entertainment as much as the sport, and making it an event. I mean, I was going to make a glib joke about my days of having a 6-day weekend are well behind me, but cramming the kind of 6-day format into a couple of nights over a Saturday and Sunday seems to be, or a Friday and Saturday, whichever, seems to be a far more appealing and kind of public, you know, a way to get the public out to buy tickets for events. And I think that some of the, you know, we're kind of bookending cyclocross and track cycling together, but I think that both these disciplines thrive when they focus on the live audience. And then once you've got a live audience, then you've got a televisual event. And then once you've got a televisual event, you've got something that can scale up and become appealing to everybody. Athletes, sponsors, a television audience. You know, there's nothing worse than kind of clinging on to the old ways of doing things for the sake of it. And the Ghent 6 lasts 6 days because the whole market of that event works over 6 nights. You know, I do think 6-day racing struggles a bit on a bigger track, 250 metres. You know, the reason the Ghent 6 is so compelling when you're there is that it's like, it is really like watching the riders whiz around in a washing machine drum, and it's exciting, and there's literally no downtime. You get to the break in the middle, and then they have some wonderful cabaret entertainment, and then the racing resumes again, and there's something to watch the whole time. And I think competitive track racing, by its very nature, has to be different to that. There's a lot more protocol, there's a lot more delays, there's a lot more kind of getting riders up onto the track, everybody getting ready, whereas a 6-day is much more about the sports attainment of it, the entertainment factor. Good to hear it's thriving.
Yeah,
there,
the only sort of slight discordant note, there's been a bit of beef about the fact that the family day has been done away with since it's been reduced to 2 days. There used to be a day when there was racing all day, quite early in the day it would start, and this was the family day, and you would get, I mean, I talked about a younger audience, but at this day you would get a lot of kids. And of course now, Lionel, as you say, it's important to make it a spectacle, in Berlin's case, and in the case of most 6-day races, a nighttime spectacle that finishes quite late at night, and so the very young kids aren't coming. But you can't satisfy everyone. Should we go on, Lionel?
Well, before we go on to the road cycling, should we talk about the Cyclocross World Championships briefly? Because Matthew van der Poel, as expected, did equal the record of Eric de Vlaeminck, 7 world titles in the men's Cyclocross World Championships. He, well, for 10 or 15 minutes, it was an absolutely terrific race, wasn't it?
And is that not all cyclocross races?
I'm being a bit glib there because there was quite a bit of drama right at the start of the race. Wout van Aert was on the fourth row of the grid as a result of having not raced all that much this cyclocross season. And he knew that he had to get up onto the coattails of Matthew van der Poel as quickly as possible if he was going to have any chance of winning the rainbow jersey. And he had a strategy to try and do that, but unfortunately it didn't work out for him. And he got boxed in and then he came a bit of a cropper against the barriers on the first corner. And so he wasn't in the right position to respond when Matthew van der Poel made the first of his attacks. And really he was playing catch up from that point on, Van Aert. He did ride very well and he did say that it was the best cyclocross race of the winter for him. And he made his way up through the field to take the silver medal, but really never got himself into contention to go elbow to elbow with van der Poel. That's not to say van der Poel had it 100% his own way, because at one point he had a flat tyre and he did slip behind Tunaerts briefly, but really when he got himself back in front, there really wasn't going to be any other winner. And so, yeah, that equals a record that has stood for 52 years, Eric de Vlaeminck's record of 7 men's world titles in the cyclocross. Matthew van der Poel is one behind Marianne Vos, I think, who has got 8 titles in the women's cyclocross. I would just say that the top 11 were either Dutch or Belgian riders. So again, you know, this is something else that we always talk about. There's nothing wrong with that at all, but kind of cyclocross embracing what it is and what it's good at, that's when it's most successful. You know, it's a sport where riders from those two countries tend to dominate. And in the women's race, I think the Dutch riders took the top 4 places. Femme Van Empel won ahead of Lucinda Brand.
Lucinda Margie, I know that. There was some kind of shoulder charge, wasn't there? You're both silent. Lucinda Brandt was in tears afterwards. I can't believe that this has fallen to me to tell you what actually happened.
Scooping us on the cyclocross.
She was nudged into some barriers, which disgraceful behaviour from Van Empel. Banner, no,
the 3-time champion for now.
I think it was 6-1, half dozen of the other.
You've seen him given though, haven't you?
I've seen him given. Anyway, anything to add, chaps, on cyclocross? We talked last week, didn't we, about Van Aert and Nace as well. We said that Nace's preparation hadn't been ideal and that there was doubts even about whether he would be competitive. Seemed to have a good tournament.
If you could all see Daniel's face now, if you could all see his, I think you really need to start getting the YouTube
just on the wind up. I'm not going to dignify this with any kind of comment.
Well, what do you want to talk about?
In my defense, I watch highlights because of course I was in Mallorca, so I'm not across all of the storylines there, but Van der Poel will have the opportunity to take that record outright if he so wishes in the Netherlands next year. I think a couple of the next 3 editions are in the Netherlands. There'll be the Hoogerheide one a couple of years
ago. He always wins there anyway, doesn't it? It's his dad's event. He's won 8 times there or something silly.
So he will likely elevate the van der Poel family above the de Vlaeminck's in the list of all-time cyclocross men's greats. And I'm just waiting to hear what Roger de Vlaeminck has to say about this. But let's transfer our attention finally to the road racing, because we've seen the kind of justification, really, of Tom Pidcock's transfer from Ineos Grenadiers to Q36.5. Because he was the man of the week at the Alula Tour in Saudi Arabia, winning 2 stages and the overall. His teammate Matteo Moschetti won the final stage, and the other 2 stages, the more sprinty stages, or 2 of the more sprinty stages, won by Tim Melier. But the outstanding rider of the week, Tom Pidcock, and we talked a bit a couple of weeks ago about Pidcock's transfer from Ineos Grenadiers and kind of how they hadn't really got the full worth of Pidcock's obvious talent and potential in terms of race wins, and a change of scenery, a change of team, and he's taken two stage wins and a general classification victory in the space of a few days. And kind of if he carries on, you know, with that sort of winning mentality and gets himself across the line, it may be, you know, sacrificing some of the biggest races, but just ticking off some wins for Q36.5, they will feel that their significant investment in him was entirely justified. A great start.
A superb start. And if you look, he's, in the space of a few days, almost doubled his win tally in his career so far. He'd won five bike races on the road. Obviously, with Tom Pidcock, you've got to factor in all the cross, the mountain bike, the far bigger races he's probably won in other disciplines. But he'd taken five professional wins before last week. He's now got eight. So two stage wins in the overall in the Alula Tour. And good for his own career, Lionel. You mentioned maybe getting the full sort of, I don't know, the worth out of his talent, getting everything out of what he can bring to it, and we'll see that over the course of the spring. There might not necessarily just be smaller races, as you put it, because they've been invited to a lot of the big classics now, most of them, I would suspect. And then I was doing the Mallorca race last week, and we've been wondering what's going to happen with the Giro, haven't we, and the invites and things like that. Are Tudor going to go to the Tour with Alaphilippe in the end? Are they going to get that invite, and that might free something else up for the Giro? Giacomo Nizzolo gave us an interview, and he was saying, yeah, I'm all right, I'm here. The typical thing, you know. We're going to go bit by bit, day by day. I'm building up the form. He says, because I want to be good in 3 months' time. What's happening in 3 months, guys? Well, it's the start of the Giro d'Italia. And I just wonder if they are going to get that invite in the end. Don't think it's nailed on, but there's a few clues hanging about.
Yeah. We expected that to be announced at the end of last week. They've been a bit ambiguous, RCS, about when exactly they're going to make the announcement. I was speaking to an agent the other day who suggested that RCS are probably waiting for ASO. And it's going to be a question, particularly with Tudor on Q36.5. If they miss out somewhere, then they will kind of get a reprieve in the other Grand Tour. So if Q36.5 don't get in at the Tour de France, then they may well get in at the Giro d'Italia, possibly even at the expense of Tudor, the other Swiss team, who, as we know, are a sponsor of the time trials, one of the time trials. They're certainly a sponsor at the Giro d'Italia. But I'm quite surprised we haven't heard anything yet from ASO. They don't generally, they don't set that in stone, do they? When D-Day is going to be. It tends to just sort of appear in your inbox.
Oh, we see that with some of the race invites as well for other races. We saw Liège come out the other week, didn't we, with the parkour as well. When it comes to the teams, there's the other factor maybe to come in. Maybe some teams are still non-organisers, might be waiting on the UCI here, because there's also a chat about 23 teams rather than 22 this year. So it's sort of like they're all standing in one of these old-fashioned westerns. The pistols are all ready, and they're waiting to see who's going to fire first, who's going to blink first, the UCI, ASO, RCS. But if another few weeks tick by, someone's just going to have to give somebody a bit of a prod and a nudge, because everybody has to get organised, don't they? Riders' race programmes, they'll want to know that, to tailor that to various races. You know, there's all the sponsorship to sort out and the logistics as well.
Just on that possibility, that prospect of an extra team in Grand Tours, just anecdotally, I've heard quite a lot over the last few months that the race organisers are getting a little bit fed up with the amount of staff that teams are bringing to races and having to shell out for hotel rooms for them. So an extra team would obviously have practical and economic implications as well for race organisers. Obviously, the Tour de France has very deep pockets, extremely deep pockets. So they might be willing to entertain that idea, but not everyone, I would suggest, will always welcome extra teams. Anything else from Saudi Arabia, chaps? Just the general level, I suppose, just thinking about Pidcock's victory, what it means. He was by far the best rider uphill, wasn't he? You've got those very, I must say, photogenic uphill finishes at Saudi Arabia. He won both of them pretty comfortably. Second to fourth place on general classification. Uno X, all Uno X riders, all Norwegians. Interestingly, upstream, slightly upstream of, well, what we saw at the weekend, the Alula Tour, Uno X's lead out man, sometimes sprinter, Søren Wærenskold, had been speaking to the Norwegian press, our colleague Magnus Orde for TV2, and he had told Magnus that he'd asked the team specifically not to be sent to Saudi Arabia for ethical reasons. He said he didn't think it would make, he wasn't making any kind of political stand, he didn't think it would make any difference, but just for his own conscience, it didn't really sit right to race in Saudi Arabia, so he didn't go. But they
had we talked a little bit about this in the Mallorca series because he was in Mallorca instead. I tried to grab a word with him on one of the final 2 days. He wasn't on the start list for the cancelled stage on Saturday, and I didn't manage to see him on Sunday, unfortunately. But yeah, I thought that was interesting, and the point I made in the Mallorca series was that, you know, he didn't have to kind of break cover and make that point that it was an ethical stance. I don't think anyone would have said, oh, why is Søren Wærenskold not gone to the Alula Tour? But yeah, his teammates there, second to fourth overall. When I first saw the GC of the Alula Tour, I did wonder, is this some kind of mountain biking, cross-country skiing mashup that we've got here, with Pidcock winning overall and then the three Norwegians right behind. But Uno X are one of these teams that are in the mix for promotion to the World Tour. I mean, they've got a bit of a fight on their hands, but certainly getting second, third and fourth in a general classification like that won't have done their points tally too much harm, I guess.
Also worth a mention, Lionel, you mentioned mountain biking. Alan Hatherley, very promising first outing for Jayco Alula. I think it was his first outing. But he, of course, is the cross-country mountain biking world champion, if I'm not mistaken. And we mentioned a few weeks ago how Jayco Alula have been pretty sort of innovative with their recruitment this year. They've taken a few riders from sort of unusual routes this year, rather than the sort of systematic blooding of the next great sort of junior or under 23 prodigy, which is what a lot of teams are doing. And Hatherley is certainly one of those sort of left field picks, and he looked very good going uphill.
Yeah, because he's 28. I mean, and he's had a kind of he's sort of had a journey towards a career on the road, but not quite made the breakthrough. I think he was in the EF Education Development Team 2 or 3 years ago. So yeah, interesting that Jayco Alula are looking sort of outside of the under 23 and junior categories there for some potential road talent.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
What else, chaps, has caught your eye over this first? This really felt like the first weekend of, as I said earlier, European racing. We had the GP La Marseillaise, which is the sort of traditional, as well as the Mallorca Challenge, the traditional season opener. A race, I imagine, Lionel, that you would share my view on this. A race that I love just visually. It's one of those races that never changes significantly in terms of the route anyway. Certainly the finale always features La Route des Crêtes and then the Col de la Gineste above Marseille. And it's a little bit of a, it reminds me in some ways of Milan-San Remo, obviously a lot less prestigious, a lot less frantic, but it's got those two not particularly difficult climbs, but nonetheless can be quite selective climbs near the finish, which you could compare to the sort of Cipressa and Poggio. And it was a pretty interesting finale, I would say. Did you chaps manage to catch any of it?
Yeah, this is the Grand Prix La Marseillaise, the traditional opening race of the French road season, won by Valentin Ferron, Iron Man of Cofidis. And again, sort of, we'll probably pick up on this promotion relegation battle. It is no coincidence, I think, that the likes of Cofidis, Astana, Uno X have kind of come out all guns blazing at the start of the season, trying to pick up as many points as they possibly can. It is a beautiful race. And it had a pretty strong field this year. I thought perhaps stronger than when I was there a couple of years ago and I made the La Marseillaise series with Francois Tomazo, exploring all aspects of cycling in and around Marseille. But Ineos Grenadiers were there, and I thought they might have made a bit more of an impact on the race, but their best rider was Axel Lens. The French rider, young French rider, who finished eighth.
They were very active in the finale. And what we saw at the weekend at La Marseillaise was similar to what we talked about. Was it last week or 2 weeks ago at the Tour Down Under, where in the run into Willunga Hill, they'd sort of taken things on and they'd split the race. And they were the sort of dominant team going on to the Col de la Geneste, or certainly the Route des Crêtes. But as you know, we talked a few weeks ago about the danger with the riders they have and the riders they've signed. A lot of really good riders who have not necessarily been winners in the past. And Axel Laurence, I mean, he has won races already in his young career, but he was their guy when it looked as though the decisive move had gone with Vauclin. But most impressively, Paul Seixas, the 18-year-old debutant for Decathlon, he's the rider who, well, the teenager who has attracted most hype in, well, certainly the last few months in anticipation of this 2025 season. And I don't know if you guys saw those two ascents, the Route des Crêtes and the Col de la Geneste. Seixas was incredible. He must have attacked 15 times or marked Vauclin or Laurence, and there was a fourth rider, I forget who the fourth rider was, but probably did too much. But then really topped it all off by finishing fifth in the sprint to the line. And yeah, it was an extremely, extremely eye-catching first performance by him.
He's only 18, isn't he? He won the junior time trial at the World Championships last year. So, yeah, sensational young talent, riding for a top team, a World Tour team at just 18. Maybe he'll be the one, the great French hope. Let's pile the weight of a nation on his shoulders, and he'll break the approaching 40-year wait for a French Tour.
Move over, Lenny Martinez. No pressure, Paul, hey?
Old man Lenny Martinez of 22 or whatever he is now.
Seixas' next race is the UAE Tour. He's going to win that, isn't he? He's going to win that. Then he's got the Tour des Alpes, or Tour of the Alps. And then he's got the Tour de la... Tour of Luxembourg, Tour of Guangxi. That's all a provisional schedule.
You laugh, though.
I fully expect him, as I say.
You laugh. Races like that, yeah. You know, if he comes and brings that sort of form that we saw at the weekend, I know it's the first day, it's excitement, it's different. You know, the results are obviously often very different. There's the famous curse of the Grand Prix in Marseille as well. Good job he didn't win, eh? But, you know, if you see him in races like that and he rides to ability, he doesn't have any sort of real teething problems, then he could be a real contender in those races. Well, I'm really, really excited to see how he goes.
Not supposed to ride a Grand Tour, but they could pivot. In all seriousness, they could pivot. If he does really well at UAE, UAE is an interesting one, I suppose, because a lot of the things we question about young riders, the placement in the peloton, can they ride in a sort of World Tour bunch, that's less of a factor at UAE than it is at some races in Europe, a race like Tirreno or Paris-Nice, isn't it? Because the roads are a lot wider and the racing is less chaotic. It's a bit more of a watts per kilo test, particularly on the uphill finishes. But yes.
Well, if he can cope with the course at Marseille, which goes through some pretty small villages and past lines of parked cars and all that kind of thing, it'll probably be okay, I would have thought. Well, we'll leave it there for today, shall we? And we will be back next week with a recap of all of the racing, including the two stage races that have got underway today. That's the Volta a la Comunitat Valenciana in Spain and the Étoile de Bessèges in the south of France. We'll probably also touch on the Tour of Oman, which gets underway at the weekend. And there might be an update on my conversation with Amnesty International about the World Championships taking place in Rwanda. And of course, we'll be another week closer to Omloop Het Nieuwsblad. In the meantime, look out for another edition of the 1101 Cappuccino coming your way if you are subscribed to our weekly newsletter on Substack. If you want to subscribe to that, go to thecyclingpodcast.com. So until next time, thank you very much, Daniel and Rob.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb and Lionel Burney.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.